Well, thank you very much for that very nice introduction. I want to walk out now while I'm on a high. That was wonderful. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I will try to speak for not more than 20 minutes if I can, because I think oftentimes the best sorts of discussions comes out when we start talking to each other and challenging each other and finding holes in each other's arguments. Since the ex-Muslim council was mentioned, I do want to just talk about that before I go into my talk. The idea behind that is that obviously your religion is your private affair, but when you're threatened to death because of your beliefs for leaving religion, then it's a public matter, and coming out publicly is a form of challenge to apostasy laws that punish people to death for leaving Islam. So that's the idea behind the ex-Muslim council. I want to talk to you, though, mainly about Sharia law today, because I think it's an important issue for people living in Britain as well as across the world. And I want to start with a case that I've been working on these past few weeks, as Mary mentioned. It's the case of Sakina Mohammad Yashtiani. She's a mother of two who's facing death by stoning in Iran. And as you know, for cases of adultery, the penalty is death by stoning. Women are buried up to their chests, men up to their waists. And the law even specifies the size of the stone to be used in the stoning. Now, Mariam was, that's another stoning victim, but Sakina was due to be executed by a stoning a few weeks ago when her 22-year-old son, who actually was in the room when they flogged her 99 times 5 years ago for having an illicit relationship, he wrote an open letter with his 17-year-old sister saying that there's no legal recourse, my mother is going to be stoned to death at any time, and the only thing we can ask for is for the people of the world to intervene and step in to try to save her life. And that's exactly what people have done everywhere. Nearly 500,000 people have signed the petition on her behalf. We just had a International Sakina Day on the 24th of July, and there were actions in over 30 cities across the world. So it's an urgent case in the sense that the Iranian government has now said that they never intended to stone her. But the embassy here has said it, in London actually, and I think it's a public relations move. They often do this. They often say they're not intending on killing someone, and they go ahead and do it in the dark of the night within prison walls. And so one of the things we're worried about is even if she's not stoned to death, that she will be executed. And obviously, you know, I think execution is wrong in all circumstances. In particular, stoning is so vile and barbaric and brutal. But, you know, it's important to keep the pressure on. And the pressure is working. The fact that she's still alive means that it works. The fact that her son went to see her a few days ago, and she said that for the first time she had hope as a result of all the people who had come out in her defense, shows that it makes a difference and it has an impact. And I'm here to ask you to also step in and intervene on her behalf. I'm sure many of you have already done that. Her lawyer is in hiding now. He's been interrogated. His wife and his brother-in-law have been arrested. And her son has been called for interrogation a number of times to ask why and how this international campaign has taken the scope that it has, how her picture got out to the public, and so on and so forth. Now, you know, when we're talking about Sharia law in Britain, oftentimes I hear, well, you know, stop talking about stoning and amputations. Iran actually amputated the limbs of 5 people last week. You know, don't talk about, hangings by cranes in city centers for acts incompatible with chastity, or the fact that being gay is an executable offense in Iran. There are 130 offenses punishable by death under Sharia law, including, you know, apostasy, blasphemy, heresy, witchcraft, so on and so forth. And the first point I guess I'd like to make is that that is Sharia law. That is the criminal code of Sharia law. And so I think it's very clever when Islamists and proponents of Sharia law, like the Archbishop of Canterbury, try to separate the two in order to give it a more palatable appearance for you know, Western public opinion. But I think the first point I want to make about Sharia law is the criminal code is part and parcel of the civil code. It's the same law. It's the same law. And, of course, death by stoning is a very different issue and concept to a woman's denying a woman the right to divorce or child custody. But the misogyny behind a law that stones a woman to death is the same one that denies her rights in the family. Now, the law that's being practiced in Britain, a lot of the West, is Sharia law, but it is the civil code of Sharia law. And the other point I want to make is that the civil code of Sharia law is one of the pillars of women's oppression in countries under Islamic rule. The fact that a woman's testimony is worth half that of a man's, the fact that a woman does not have unilateral right to divorce, whereas men do, the fact that girls and wives get half the inheritance of brothers and of children, boy children, or the brothers of the relative of the husband that's deceased. The fact that a woman is not allowed to sign even her own marriage contract. A male guardian has to sign it on her behalf. This is Sharia law, and it's civil, the civil aspects of Sharia law. And I think, I find it offensive actually when people say that, you know, it's, don't bring in the issue of stoning. These are the more palatable aspects. And it's interesting how when it comes to denying women's rights in the family, they seem to be the more palatable aspects. Whereas in fact, I think it's scandalous that these laws should be applied to a large number of our citizens in this country. Now, the Sharia councils and Muslim arbitration tribunals that are a majority, that do the majority rulings in this country, Sharia councils, have, according to their own statistics, dealt with over 7,000 cases. These courts are denying women the right to divorce, the right to child custody, these are the main issues, but there's also issues of enforcing compulsory veiling to even issuing death fatwas. These councils have done that. I'm glad I shut off my phone, it's not mine. I think that in itself is quite scandalous. We've just done a report, I don't know if you've seen it, the One Law for All campaign, which is campaigning against Sharia law in Britain. And it's called A Threat to One Law for All and Equal Rights. And in this report, we've tried to bring forth our arguments on why Sharia courts in this country should be banned because they are violating women's rights, equality before the law, and they contravene British law as well as UK public policy, as well as human rights. And just to give you two examples of how that happens is in the area of, one of it is in the area of child custody. Now, as you know, under British law, well, I know there's no such thing as British law, but under English law or Welsh law, whatever, there is an important concern that's been the result of many years of struggle for children's rights, where the welfare of the child is paramount in under every circumstances. And in a child custody case, for example, it's what's best for the child that is of concern. So when the judge decides on who gets child custody, it's, you know, what's best for the child. Does it go to the mother, to the father? Do they have joint custody? Under Sharia law, custody of the child goes to the father at a preset age, irrespective of the welfare of the child. So even if the mother has fled a violent situation, even if the father is deemed to be abusive, nonetheless, child will go to the father at a preset age. Now this has actually been happening in Britain. So we have cases where Sharia councils, which are not even acting as tribunals under the arbitration tribunal, they're charities. They have set up courts and denied women the right to child custody and given it to the father at this age. And We've got cases, for example, of people who've come to us and said, we've gone to a British court and we've got a fatwa against us from the Sharia Council saying that we have to be boycotted because we've dared to go to a British court rather than to the Sharia Council. So there's all this threats and intimidation that goes around these sorts of courts and councils as well. And people's rights are being denied as a result. Now, we'll go into that because I know it's quite confusing. I know there's this, you know, I think the main argument in support of these councils is that, well, people go there voluntarily. And I guess our response is that it's not that voluntary for many people because of the pressures and threats and intimidations involved. I mentioned a case that came to us who had received a boycott order, an expulsion order from the Islamic community because he dared to come to a British court instead of a Sharia council. But there are a number of studies which we also mention in our report where, for example, one university law professor, she did a study on Sharia councils where she sat in on 10 cases and 4 of the cases actually had injunctions against their husbands for threatening behavior. So actually, the husband was not even meant to be in the same room with his wife or former wife, and he was using the council as a way of renegotiating child custody issues, divorce settlement issues, and that sort of thing. So I think it's comparable with living, under a system where religion has state power, and even though it doesn't have state power in Britain, it has a huge amount of influence as a result of Islamism's political power in other countries and other parts of the world. And so the threats and intimidations that people face are very real. The other argument that's often given in support of these councils is, well, if you're not happy with it, go to a British court. But it's not that simple, again, given the pressures that are involved. There are a lot of people whose rights are violated, who are dissatisfied with the results of the councils, but who dare not go to a British court. And therefore, what we're actually doing by allowing these courts to survive, to expand and increase, you know, on a daily basis, is that we're leaving larger and larger numbers of people at the mercy of these courts. The last point I want to make, and then I'll leave it open for discussion because there's so many issues around this. Two more points, sorry. One issue is obviously that one of the arguments in support of these sorts of courts is that, you know, people have a right to their religion. And I think that it's a mistake to think that this has anything to do with people's right to religion. This is the right of Islamism to repress and restrict citizens in this country and across the world. This is a demand of the political Islamic movement, not a demand of Muslims. Now, if you look at, if you've come to any of our rallies, we've had Muslim women come and speak and say, you know, none of us had to go to Sharia councils 30 years ago. It wasn't the thing we had to do. Now we have to do it. And you have, you know, someone like the Muslim woman counselor from Tower Hamlets, Sharia Khatun, who gets death threats for not being veiled, saying that, you know, there's more pressure on me to be veiled in Tower Hamlets than there is when I go back home to Bangladesh, you know. And I think what we need to understand is that this is very much the result of the rise of the Islamic movement. Why there are more burqas on the streets of London, why there are more Sharia councils. And I think to say this is people's right to religion is leaving large numbers of our citizens, not just British citizens, but world citizens, at the mercy of a brutal, misogynist, inhuman, medieval movement that will stone people to death in the 21st century if given the chance. And will deny women rights in the family in Britain if given the chance, and is doing that. And I think it's important to stand up and be heard and push back this movement. Not just because it's important to push back Islamism, but because it's important to defend people's rights, equal rights, women's rights, human rights, things that have been fought for, are not Western concepts, but universal concepts that are the demand of people living in a small village in Iran, or Afghanistan to the demand of people living in a metropolitan city in Britain or Tehran. Finally, I'd like to say that rights, equality, respect, these are things that have been raised by progressive social movements vis-a-vis human beings, not religions, not beliefs, and not reactionary political movements. And I think the more we give rights to these political movements, to religion and belief, to do whatever it wants, irrespective of the consequences on people's lives, we restrict the space for real live human beings. We deny people rights, and we deny them the freedoms that they deserve. And so I think the battle for Sharia, to oppose Sharia law in this country, is a battle against it across the world. And it's a battle in defense of secularism, in defense of universal values, and in defense of a life that's really worthy of the 21st century. Thank you.
Right. I'm sure that we're going to end up with quite a lot of people wanting to ask things. Have we got any hands already? No. Yes.
Hello.
Back row.
Always start with a woman, don't
you? Right, sorry. Go there. Yes.
You mentioned that the law is affecting Muslims and affecting Muslim women. How far is it actually affecting Western, British people as well? I did meet a British teacher who was teaching in a very predominantly Islamic school, not an Islamic school, but a lot of Islamic children there. She helped a girl who was being abused by her father and ended up having a fatwa on her. She ended up having to leave her house. She couldn't be employed by another anybody within the county. None of the other schools would touch her because it was dangerous. And she ended up having to go to hiding. Now that was a British woman. This was several years ago. I just wondered how much it's affecting British people we don't actually hear about.
Do you want
to spend anything
else?
Yes.
Hello, thank you. My name is Valerie. I just wanted to ask you this. We were in a workshop earlier today when we were looking at the law in this land in all sorts of practical ways. And there was a general consensus, perhaps, that we would wish to have a law that was the reasonable approach, the way in which people could communicate and come together with a common approach, rather than bringing law to force people to do things, like a dispute perhaps between neighbours, better than coming freely rather than taking to law. With regard, and I agree with everything you say about me, what sounds like the awfulness of Sharia law, can you see a way forward between the demands of Sharia law and the hope that it might come into use here, and the UK law or the English law, which obviously is very different? Can you see a way that there might be a betweenness, a compromise, a coming together? This is the essence of it, because while two different sides see it so very differently, it would never happen. And although we wouldn't wish women to be treated in the way that Sharia law seems to apply, the backlash that Miranda just mentioned may be one of the reasons why there's been progress on no meeting of minds on this matter. Do you understand the essence of what I'm asking?
There's quite a lot of points that I'd like to quickly mention if I can. I think the first thing I'd like to stress in going to the issues you raised was that, one, there's a distinction, and I think it's an important one that we have to keep remembering, a distinction between Muslims and Islamism. It's the distinction between a British person and the British National Party. It's the distinction between Nazis and Germans. It's a huge distinction. What's happened, though, is that Islamism feigns to represent Muslims. The Muslim Council of Britain, which is, in my opinion, the political branch of the Islamic regime of Iran and Al-Qaeda, no different, no different in the vision they have for society. And between Muslims, and the difference between, you know, someone who is a Muslim and has different interpretations of the Quran, wants to still be gay or have sex outside of marriage or drink alcohol or go to a disco, or doesn't want to do any of these things but doesn't cut the throat of his daughter for doing it, like my father. My father's a Muslim. Never once, ever, ever, ever threatened or harmed me and always encouraged and supported me as an atheist. So I'm just saying that there's a distinction between these two, and it's important to remember that. The other point is that the Muslim women in this country are British as well. Do you know what I mean? I mean, and that's the other thing. This is what religion does. You know, when I think this is the biggest problem I have with religion, and I have a lot of problems with religion, is it's so segregationist in a sense. You know, it's somehow Britain is a Christian Britain or a Christian Europe, and I think the far right uses this a lot. And you know, the thing I always tell them is, if this was a Christian Europe, woe be upon us. You know, it's actually a result of pushing back, you know, the Inquisition and Christianity and political power, that we have any sorts of freedoms and rights that you hold dear. Not because of Christianity, that's for sure. Sorry, but yeah, anyway. I'm going to offend a lot of people throughout the day, so I think one is that, yes, they're also British, you know, and I think, you know, I've just got my British citizenship maybe 2 weeks ago, you know, but I've always felt part of the society, and I think most people do, where they live, where they work, where they raise their families, you know. So in that sense, I think we have to look at it as something, as an attack on all of us, you know. And you can imagine if a teacher who is not Muslim, who is part of, you know, is part of the established British society, in the sense that she's got a job as a teacher, if she's in hiding, what do you think is happening to Muslim women who are forced to wear the burqa or under the thumb and the boot of the Islamic movement? What do you think is happening to them? And I think if her life is in danger and the lives of other people who dare to speak out, what is happening to all those women who are being, you know, oppressed, silenced, beaten, and have nowhere to go? And you have the establishment saying, it's your right to go to Sharia courts. It's your choice. You know, in fact, these sorts of things just limit even further the rights and space that women have, and all of us have in a society. I think if you agree that Sharia law is the demand of Islamism, the more it advances, the less rights and freedoms we all have. You know, and I think that, you know, in my opinion, one of the reasons the Archbishop of Canterbury is so in love with Sharia law is because it helps him too. I think you notice how they all come together, from the Vatican to the Islamic Republic of Iran, when they want to limit people's rights. Suddenly, they're, you know, all their sectarianism and disagreements are naught, and they unite to, you know, deny single mothers, I don't know, welfare in America, to people getting AIDS, treatment on AIDS, and contraceptives, and so on and so forth. The other issue is that I don't think there should be any compromise with religious law, none whatsoever. And I think until we believe that there is a possibility of compromise, we are going to lose. Is there a compromise between an idea that thinks a woman must be veiled, a girl at the age of 9 must be covered up, she can't listen to music, she can't play sports with boys, she can't have the same, she can't even study the same things boys do, she's not allowed to go into certain fields of study, she's not allowed to leave the house without her father or her male guardian's permission, that sexual apartheid is the rule of the day? How are you going to compromise with that? It is compromising with misogyny, it's compromising with barbarity, medievalism, and inhumanity. I think people obviously have a right to their religion and their beliefs. People can criticize my opinions, and I can criticize theirs. But when that religion is part of the law, when it's part of the educational system, when it's part of the state, it becomes so very dangerous. And so many people are oppressed as a result of it.
Can we just see if Val wants to come back on that? Do you want to say anything yourself, Val, about what you were thinking of in terms of compromise?
I was thinking of the basis of anthropism synthesis, I mean, you get two points of view. And finally, a compromise. You may not like that word, but a synthesis. Your examples, I am more. But we will not make progress with any group we disagree with unless we can find a commonality and some small way forward. That's all I think.
I'm sorry, can I finish?
I think Patty's speaking to the same point. Yeah?
Issue as well, and I didn't get a chance. If I can just talk for a few more minutes, I'm sorry. I think if I can, and your point as well, let me start with this then, and then go back to my last point. The thing is that, yes, there's no problem with arbitration. We're not saying nobody is allowed to arbitrate. In fact, arbitration tribunals were set up as a way of allowing for people also to be able to not go to court, to deal with small issues, and choose the person they want to be the judge, you know. And also because of specializations, for example, if it's a business transaction or something to do with legal transactions that a civil judge might not really know about, that you would have someone who is well versed in these sort of the intricacies of these laws. Now, so the two points on this is that, yes, there are 300 arbitration tribunals in this country. Our practical recommendation is that there should be no religious arbitration when it comes to civil matters, right? So obviously, if you have a problem on a legal issue or with your neighbor, go ahead. But when you're arbitrating on civil matters, marriage, child custody, where and religious law is obviously very unequal and particularly discriminatory against women and children, that's where it shouldn't happen. And we have a case where this has happened successfully. This in Canada, there was an attempt by the Sharia courts there to use the Arbitration Act there. The government was first agreeing, the Ontario province government first agreed, but as a result of a huge campaign, it eventually, after a couple of years, said, look, no religious arbitration in civil matters. No Islamic court, no Jewish court, no native Indian courts, finished. And that's what we're trying to do here. So as a practical means, I think that's what needs to be done. And I think, again, I guess this is, I'm just going to say this one more time, is that you have to see a distinction between Islamism and Muslims. Sakine Mohammadi Ashtiani is not demanding to be stoned to death for adultery. It is the regime that is stoning her. The woman that goes to the court and loses her most beloved child is not demanding to lose child custody. It is the imam and the, someone like Anjan Chaudhary, who wants Sharia law for Britain, you all know him, he's a Sharia judge. He is demanding it. And I think that's why when you talk about compromise, you're actually talking about compromising with the Islamic movement. And I think the other issue that's important is that I think what's happened with multiculturalism, which I despise, is that it's reduced everything to cultures, and you forget to see the human being in there. You know, so in a sense, I think we've got to say people have rights, people are equal. Not necessarily all cultures and beliefs are equal and equally valid, but nonetheless, you have a right to them. Keep them out. Keep them out. In fact, we will treat people better and more equal if we treat them as citizens, irrespective of their beliefs, nationality, so on and so forth.
Right. Can we move on? Are there any questions?
Yes, it's Philip here.
Thank you very much. How hopeful are you of the possibility of isolating Islamism from an Islam which may come to share secular values?
Do you want to take that alone or another one?
Yeah, I'll take another one as well.
I've enjoyed your critique of multicultural discussion. I think it's an argument that's very difficult to make happen because if you stand up as a white person and argue against multiculturalism.
Slow down.
Sorry,
can you
stand up?
Hold it to your mouth.
No, okay. I'm a bit more slowly this evening. Thank you. It's very difficult to argue against multiculturalism as a white man because you will always get accused of being a racist. So it's actually very difficult to advance the argument you've advanced very eloquently and forcefully. I find it very difficult to argue sometimes because one is always conscious of being criticised for being a racist in that context. And so I've often argued against Islamism in the way that you describe it because it does enshrine the oppression of women. So you see the birth on the streets of London and it gets you angry, it gets my girlfriend furious. But I know if I go out and argue against it and say this is barbaric, this is Stone Age, I'll be accused of being anti-Muslim or anti-Islamic. And I don't think of myself in those terms, but I do think of myself as a passionate believer in equal rights and universal rights for all. And so one problem in that context is, who do I solidarize with? Who can I point to and say to my friends, no, I'm not a racist, Islamophobe, I'm a passionate believer in equal rights. It'd be nice to be able to point to someone and say, just like these people. And so I've worked with many secular Muslims at work who share the same values that I share, who believe in their own version of God, not my version of God. Also, I don't believe in any God. But the point is that there's no voice expressing their secular intent, but their Islamic, what the word is, colleagues, fellow travellers, or non-fellow travellers. There's nothing I can point to in British society to say, it's not just me, other people within the Muslim community feel very strongly about these issues and they're not happy to be represented. Misrepresented in that way, and that's one difficulty one has in trying to argue against the more reactionary aspects of multiculturalism and controversialism and the terrible mind that puts us in so far as it forces us to lose sight of values that we've fought a long time for in the West, in terms of the separation of church and state, the separation of religion and law, the application of human rights.
Yes,
Allah.
I think with regards to the question was it you? Sorry. On Islamism versus Islam that embraces secularism. I think, as we all know, I mean, it's not like the Archbishop of Canterbury or the various bishops and the Anglican bishops from Paul Robertson in America. I don't think any of them really embrace secularism. Secularism is a threat to, I think, people who are part of the religious establishment in a sense. But I think it is possible for them to be able to coexist with secularism, as we're seeing in many parts of the world. I think it's not necessarily because, and that's my personal opinion, because of religion itself, but because of how far it's been pushed back as a result of, something like the Enlightenment. So in that sense, I think that there will be a time when Islam will be seen to be less abusive and threatening and causing mayhem and murder, but that's only when we push it back, and we need an enlightenment against Islamism today. So oftentimes when people say, but I can do this, or we're living in a free society, I say, well, compare yourself to being an atheist today, or to being one under the Spanish Inquisition. And we are living under an Islamic Inquisition, in my opinion. And so everything is very different, and I think a political battle against it is what will help people within the Muslim community. And I put that in quotes because people have so many characteristics and they're always boxed into this sort of thing. But when it's pushed back, they'll be able to speak more freely. So you will see many more free thinkers, atheists, gays, lesbians, and so on and so forth as a result. And you're seeing a lot now too because people are, regardless of the intimidation they receive, pushing the boundaries. I think what's key is what's happening in Iran, because Iran had a left-leaning revolution which was expropriated by the Islamic movement and has now been called an Islamic revolution for over 30 years. And I think with the protest there, if it is able to push back the Islamic movement, it will have huge repercussions on weakening that movement internationally. On the issue of multiculturalism, I think it is a problem. You know, it is a problem. Rightfully, there's been a wonderful anti-racist movement in the West that has had great impact and makes people careful about what they say. And I think that's a good thing, you know. But I think also we need to be careful about letting Islamists use it as a way, because they become very savvy in using rights language. You know, Sharia court is a right and a choice, whereas actually it restricts choices and rights. The burqa is liberating for women. And this very thing of any criticism of religion or the Islamic movement being deemed to be racist, I think it's uncomfortable, but we just have to go ahead and do it. Do you know what I mean? I think I remember about, I don't know, 15 years ago, actually getting kicked off a forum in Canada for because of an article I had written on Islam, political Islam, and women's rights that now is celebrated as a wonderful article. But then I was actually kicked out under their racism policy, and it was criticizing Islam and political Islamic movement. And I think you just have to keep pushing ahead and saying, look, irrespective of, you know, what labels are being given, it's right and it's a duty for us to be able to stand up and speak about things that are wrong, you know. And you don't need to be Muslim to know there's something wrong, as you don't need to be black to know that apartheid in South Africa was wrong. And I think to point at, the One Law for All is an important campaign, because there are many Muslims who've joined the One Law for All campaign. And I think the more that this campaign goes forward, the more we'll feel free to come and join this campaign. And I think that is crucial then, to have your support and to be able to point to that as something that shows that there are so many people who are opposed to Sharia law but are proud to be Muslims.
Right. What?
Dave first.
Right. About multiculturalism, I suggest that we take a multiculturalism as well. I've lived and worked in Saudi Arabia for over 10 years. So I know a little about Sharia. I know a fair amount about Islam. And what we've got in this country is, in fact, cultural differences being brought forward. It is the people from our country, the peasants, who are bringing these oppressive moves to this country. I think the legal situation with direction is no problem, but it is the fact that we, by not speaking up, encourage this multiculturalism taking too far.
Thank you. We've got a gentleman. Is it this gentleman? Thank you. Say something.
I honestly don't think I need the mic. You do, actually. Okay, well, I'm right. You don't like mics. Okay.
Please put it to your mouth.
Okay. If a fatwa involves threat of violence,
any other points that link at all of those to John at the back?
I'm not sure this goes along with the other question, but here I am, an American in Britain, asking you, what about what's going on in France, where there are active attempts to ban certain, I'll say, Islamic Muslim practices? Is that the way?
We've got
10 minutes,
okay.
And maybe a few more questions.
On the issue of cultural relativism, I'm going to reiterate my point, is that it's, okay. If we take this room of people, we all have different beliefs and different cultural values. Some of them might be similar and some of them aren't. You know, you can't call Britain a Christian country. I know some people do, but, or in the same way you can't call Iran a Muslim or an Islamic country. You can call it an Islamic state, But there are so many people resisting Islam in Iran, and there's actually a huge anti-Islamic backlash there. So I guess the thing is that the problem with cultural relativism is that what it does is it boxes everyone into having one culture and one sort of value. And it always ends up being the most reactionary, most misogynist, most homophobic, most inhuman cultural values that exist on earth, you know. So the Muslim community then becomes, you know, this reactionary sort of group that wants Sharia law, that wants the burqa, that wants FGM, and so on and so forth. And so I guess the first, I think the important point about cultural relativism is that what it does is, one, it limits what people really are and think, and actually hands them over to those who, you know, the ruling elite that actually decides what that culture is supposed to be, which in the Islamic world is obviously Islamic states and the Islamic movement. And so, in a sense, I think I wouldn't say that it's the peasants bringing Islamism into Europe, because, you know, this is the thing about, this is a far-right argument. I'm not saying you're bringing that, sorry. I'm just explaining this, what I have a problem with the far-right, is that they blame Muslims for Islamism. And it annoys me, because Muslims are the first victims of Sharia law. They're at the forefront of resisting it. You know, Sakina's son is getting threatened, her lawyer is in hiding for trying to stop stoning. And then now suddenly it's Sakina's culture, you know, it's the culture of, veiling is their culture, whereas they, you know, according to the Islamic regime's own statistics, they've arrested 1 million women in one city for improper veiling. So it's obviously, and if it's their culture, why do they need threats and intimidations and all this police and revolutionary guards and so on and so forth to suppress people in the street? Even what they wear, to the extent of entering people's home to stop them from listening to the music that they want, you know. So I think this is the problem with cultural relativism. It makes it seem like it's, you know, it's what they want. And I think it's not that simple, first off. And second off, I think this is something a Muslim woman said something really good, and I've said it before at one of our rallies, is that, look, 30 years ago, this was not the case. Or the Muslim woman counselor I mentioned saying, I didn't need to wear a veil 30 years ago. I'm freer in Bangladesh than I am in Tower Hamlets. And I think that's why we've got to sort of make that difference between Muslims and Islamism. I think that's really important. And the other issue is, yes, it is a crime. It is a crime. But if I go to the police with a death threat, they don't even bother to listen to the phone conversation I've received to track the phone call. So I don't go anymore. And I find it funny because I actually got a call yesterday from someone saying they're really afraid. They've got all these death threats. And I tell them, go to the police, because that's what people have to do. But I know that they're not. The police is not going to do anything. But I, you know, and I've told this woman that, but I've said, you've got to keep going until they start taking action and taking these threats seriously. And as you say, they give fatwas to kill people, and they're walking free. You know, and this is part of the problem and the hold that religion has as being something sacred. In France, I think the French are doing quite a good job. I would go a lot further. I think you should ban the burqa. The burqa is a mobile prison. The burqa is like foot binding, like the chastity belt. Is that liberating? Is that a choice? I mean, when I hear these arguments, I sometimes really want to scream that how far behind we've gone. 100 years ago, women's rights campaigners wouldn't dare to say something like this. And yet today you have feminists and liberals defending the burqa and defending, the most vile restrictions on women's rights. I think it's unacceptable, really.
We've got just a few minutes. Anyone from this side? Yes. Oh, in the middle.
That's all for everybody. I think one of the serious things that has gone wrong with our society is that the idea of a multicultural society was that we had a single society, a secular society with a single law of all, in which all cultures were welcomed for the contribution they make to the society as a whole. That was the basic principle of multiculturalism. It was not intended in any way to give rights to a particular community to set themselves up as almost as a state within a state, which is what seems to be happening here. Now, I think one of the things that is contributing to this is that we are beginning to develop a ghetto culture. The Muslims who suffer, I think, particularly from Sharia North, tend to live in areas where there are no other people but Muslims. And now, this was not what multicultural society was meant to bring about. What it was meant to bring about was a diffusion of people of all beliefs and cultures throughout the society in an even way. So that's why we've got a problem. I think it is totally unacceptable that we should ever deviate from the principle that we are one society and one law. I mean, with that, I think probably we are all in agreement. I think the problem is, it's exactly what we do about the situation which is now developed, because it's part of it is geographical as well as a religious problem. We have areas which are almost alien to our general culture as a whole, in that they are a particular monoculture which is setting itself up against the society as a whole. I think that's the problem that I think we need guidance on how to address.
Needs to be the last one, but
I'd be glad to hear your views on the British government's hand. I'd be glad to hear your views on the present government's plans to increase the number of free schools and the way they propose to invest.
Depressing, isn't it? I'm sorry, we're almost done.
12.
I don't have the time.
Can you just say something quickly about that?
On the issue of one law for all and what we need to do, I think you know, there's a lot of things that can be done. One is to challenge the Islamic movement, you know, whether it's challenging the burqa or Sharia courts in Britain or the Islamic regime of Iran, because it is a global movement that's very much linked. I remember in Ayat Banglawala from the Muslim Council of Britain, when Salman Rushdie was threatened, there was a fatwa against him by Khomeini. He said, he's quoted as saying, "Oh, I felt so good that in Iran there's someone who understands how I feel," you know. And likewise, you know, what I always say is that we also have lots of people who know how we feel in Iran and Afghanistan and Iraq, and who want secularism and who want 21st century life. So in that sense, I think battling political Islam is really important. The other is really pushing back multiculturalism and demanding a citizenship, you know, without all these differences, you know. A citizenship without your religion and your culture and your ethnicity and whatever attached onto you. I mean, I have a 4-year-old, he's almost 5-year-old son that started nursery. He's just finished it this few days ago. And, you know, already the teachers are bringing boxes of Islam and this and that, and I think, my poor child, you know, what chance is he going to have? We're already there shoving down religion down his throat, and he's 4. You know, and already they're establishing all these differences. And so in a sense, I think it's important to keep fighting for the principle that people have a right to their opinions. Children in particular have no beliefs. They don't have a political belief, and they certainly don't have a religious belief. It's the beliefs of their parents. And they should be treated as, you know, citizens. If we're so worried about their welfare, I'm not sure why we allow religion to run such havoc in their lives. And I think that comes to the issue of schools as well. I mean, I think it's a huge mistake. It's a huge mistake to, you know, have free schools, to have a rise in religious schools. It segregates children. It gives them an unlevel playing field, and I think it just helps to perpetrate the problem that we're in already. And so I think obviously the demand for, you know, schools that are not religious schools is an important one. I know it's very difficult in Britain because of the history of the Church of England and the numbers of schools, religious schools in this country, and the fact that multiculturalism is equality between schools. So we have 5,000 Church of England schools, now we need 5,000 Islamic schools. It'll never end. And, you know, the importance of pushing forward the fight for actually children's rights. And it is child abuse, in my opinion, to put children in a veil at the age of 9, to sexualize them at that age, to tell them that they're different from boys, and to stick them in a school that teaches them that they are different and don't have the same world. Right. If I can just finally just end by saying that I have a report on the Sharia issue here. I think it's a really good report if you'd like to read it. It is £5 because we still haven't been able to pay for the printing cost, so unfortunately we can't give it free even though we would like to. But I've got a couple if you'd like to buy them, that would be brilliant. The other is we're trying to get lawyers to support Sakina's lawyer. He's in hiding now. His wife and brother-in-law have been arrested in Iran. So if there are any lawyers here who could help with a campaign, a legal campaign on his behalf, or even to sign a letter, if you can come and speak to me afterwards as well. Thank you.
Before I give up this microphone, I've got one question which I want to ask to Dr. Cupid, but in the remarks that he's going to follow, a few years ago, you said, talking about religious fundamentalism, you wrote in me that you thought that this was a short-term phenomenon which would decay and die. I wonder, and you were talking about Christian fundamentalism now, in the light of what you've heard this morning, I wonder whether you're still of the same opinion and how that applies to religious fundamentalism generally. Could you address that in your remarks, please?
Right. I was just going to hand over to Don by saying, so Don is now going to do what none of us are capable of doing. We've had some really interesting comments, but he's got 10 minutes to say profound, challenging, summative things about what Marion said, and now David's told him that he wants something else as well. He's really good at that. So over to you, Don.
How did we ever get into this terrible mess about ethics? Let's start by thinking a moment about the words ethics and morals. Ethics is from the Greek word ethos, plural ethica, meaning customs. Morals is from the Latin word mos moris, meaning customs. That's to say, ethics and morals are the same word, one Greek, one Latin, and they both originally referred simply to the customs of a particular society. We get an echo of this in the Victorian books that were very often titled The Manners and Morals of a Particular People. They use the phrase manners and morals where we use the phrase culture. Morality was originally simply evolved social customs. An amusing example of this in the Hebrew Bible is when Amnon assaults his sister Tamar, and she in protest says, such a thing is not done in Israel. It sounds rather like an Edwardian school story, doesn't it? The done thing. But that's how it began. But over the centuries, customs evolve into traditions. Traditions gradually evolve into religious law. And then in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment...
Sorry,
you've got my jacket. Yes, that's right.
The mic is on.
I've got the mic now. Yes, thank you.
I'll tell you how well.
Yes.
The mic is on your jacket.
That's all right, yeah. You can hear me as well. Can you hear me?
No, it's all right. They're trying to tell you you've now got two mics.
Oh. Okay, it's all right. Somebody take this away. Thank you.
Leave it.
Yes, I was saying, ethics and morals originally meant just customs for done things. That evolved into traditions, into culture, but then as the great religions evolved, it evolved into divine law. What began simply as custom ends as an obligation, a sacred obligation, punished very severely. And all three of our religions of the book, Judaism and Christianity and Islam, became religions with a very prominent tradition of law. In Islam, it was particularly severe in that there's no separate priesthood in Islam. The law applied to everybody, whereas in Christianity, of course, canon law applied principally to the clergy and applied principally to them today. And gradually, in the West, we shook off the constraint of religious law from the Reformation onwards. The last person in Europe to be burnt for heresy, I think, was a Scot in Edinburgh in 1694 who thrown doubt on the doctrine of the Trinity. The last witch burning was in Spain in 1828. But remember that the emancipation of homosexuals, the legalization of abortion, the reasonably full achievement of equal rights for women has happened only within the lifetime of most people here. So it's only quite recently that we in the West have achieved such a degree of emancipation as we've got. Now, there's a complication. When a society is under pressure and the old men feel that things are falling apart, there's a temptation to tighten the screws of social control. And this has happened in Christianity, in Judaism, and in Islam. In Christianity, think how fundamentalism fights back against modern culture, critical thinking, and neglect of God by being doctrinally very hard-edged and by persecuting homosexuals, abortionists, and so on. In Judaism, the liberality of Europe in the 19th century was such that the Jews felt they were threatened by assimilation. So they reaffirmed the ritual, the legal side of their own faith in order to develop Zionism. And in Islam, the decline of the Ottoman Empire and the political decline of Islam versus the West led from the 18th century onwards to the Islamist reaffirmation. Now, I still insist that in all faiths, this ultra-conservative reaction is a defensive reaction on the part of weak old men trying to keep young in check, and they will lose in Iran as elsewhere. Surely, the number of people in Islam, given a choice, who would opt for a Taliban-like society, is only about a quarter or a fifth of the population at the most. So I think in the long run, Western culture will win, and I believe that in our present conflict out there, we should switch the emphasis to culture and behave more intelligently. For example, instead of fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan for the sake of a government which from our point of view is equally bad, we would do better to be much more generous in granting political asylum to women. Why should there not be something like the Underground Railroad in America in the 1850s, smuggling young women out of Afghanistan? The old men might gradually begin to realise if their society lost its women, they wouldn't last very long anyway. And I do think that for the sake of education and for the sake of avoiding sexual coercion, younger women ought to be given political asylum in the West and settled here. Why not? It'd be much cheaper and better in terms of human happiness than fighting ruinously expensive and largely futile wars. So my own belief is that the conflict here is cultural. In the long run, a morality of individual freedom and human rights will prevail, but it's a hard struggle and we need to fight it intelligently.
Thank you very much. I just want to add a brief postscript to the last point John was making. I was talking only a couple of weeks ago with a man who has spent a lot of time working in Afghanistan on attempting the constructive reconstruction. I said to him, why don't we get some of these young women over here? He said, oh Mary, it's happening. It's one of the things we've been promoting. Of course it's done quietly. The thing is, we have to bring their families as well, because otherwise it's not like Bangladeshi community. There aren't masses of relatives here. So they have to bring the whole group. But it is happening. And if, obviously, one of the things they need, he's not campaigning for this, but it costs money, and I can certainly talk to him. If anybody wants to email me and say, can I do anything, I will get hold of him again within the next few weeks, and I'll tell him anything, but you might be able to.
All right. What about the immigration?
Yeah. Thank you. Lovely. Free time.